Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Getting It Done, and I'm your host, Walter Dean, or Dr. Dean, whichever one you would prefer calling. This show right here airs twice a week. This was basically a once-a-week jazz show, and the other day, on a Monday, when we do broadcast, also was a day when we just conversed and talked about different issues in our society. And I had so many complaints from some of you listeners about the sound of the jazz, so I just decided to change everything over and do a complete talk and a historical perspective kind of show. Today's show has two parts. The first is an information about, or the conclusion of Sally Hemings that we started last week or on Monday. The woman that had Thomas Jefferson's children and continued to be his slave throughout her life. So let's go back and find out about what caused her to do that. Now, we know that President Jefferson had sex with Sally when she was only 14 years old. And Jefferson lived today, if he did, that would be considered rape. However, she was a slave, and I guess he felt he could do what he really wanted to her. This has happened before. He was actually president of the United States. He wasn't even president of the United States when this happened. But still, people voted for him as president of the United States. Now, this tells you what kind of mortality or morality was around with those who voted for him. Look, this is still happening today, and men and women are able to vote for who they want as president of the United States. You get my drift? So let's go on, and when we finish with Sally Hemings, we're going to go on to two fantastic giant ladies, black ladies, during the Civil War and during slavery period of time, and maybe after that. Let's listen to Sally Hemings anyway. Here we go.
And began to attend social functions with her father.
We assume that Sally Hemings would have certainly prepared her for these outings, but probably accompanied her on a number of them as well. There are indications in the fact that Jefferson suddenly began buying Sally Hemings more clothing at the same time that he bought his daughter Patsy more clothing.
There were letters that came to Patsy from friends that she had in Paris, and in the letters they always mentioned Sally. Sally seemed to be more a part of what was going on in Patsy's life than she would have been at Monticello.
It would also seem that Ambassador Jefferson was one of those who began to treat Sally differently in Paris. In fact, her son Madison Hemings makes it quite clear in his memoirs that during that time, my mother became Mr. Jefferson's concubine. The teenage slave from Virginia had forged a completely new life in an exciting and foreign land. Soon, Sally Hemings would be forced to make a choice between the freedom of Paris and returning to America with Thomas Jefferson. In the late 1780s, Sally Hemings was a slave living in a country where slavery didn't exist. She was living in the home of her master, Thomas Jefferson, the American ambassador. The teenager was growing into a stunning young woman, affectionately called Dashing Sally, and described by others as handsome, with long hair flowing down her back.
The relationship between Jefferson and Hemings probably started in the late 1780s when they were together in Paris, and she was about a 14 or 15-year-old girl.
By 1788, the widow Jefferson was waxing eloquently in letters about the domestic virtues of American women and life at home.
Jefferson talks about women in his letters as the guardians of virtue in that family unit. and a belief that the bucolic rural farming world of Virginia is his real favorite and his ideal.
Jefferson was homesick. With his daughters away at school, perhaps he found Sally to be a link to the world he romanticized and yearned for in Virginia. But their relationship might not have been as romantic as their home in the City of Lights suggests.
The debate now has been, was it love or was it rape? And that, in one sense, is an unanswerable question. I have always thought that there had to be some semblance of respect. I don't know if love is too strong a word, but that's something that held those two together.
It was probably, in some sense of the term, consensual, meaning both parties agreed to it. Though it was clearly rooted in Jefferson's power. Jefferson owned this woman. And so to call it consensual between master and slave seems a bit of a contradiction.
Jefferson may have been truly attracted to Sally Hemings, perhaps even loved her, but that could not change her station in life.
I think that he had affections and feelings for Sally. I think he was probably very possessive about her as well. But in the meantime, it was okay for him to keep her family and her in situations where they lived as house servants would live. In the private time, when no one's around and it's just the two of them, of course, now you have man and woman.
And how she felt about him? Who knows? Being owned is not exactly a desirable state of affairs. He could break his promises at any time to her. So she managed him very well, I think.
In the Paris of 1789, Jefferson was enjoying his role as a patron saint and advisor as the masses stormed the Bastille and launched the French Revolution. Then his well-ordered world came crashing down.
Patsy threatens to convert to Catholicism. As soon as he hears that, he removes her from the convent and makes plans to return to Virginia.
Still, Jefferson had an even bigger problem.
According to Madison Hemings' account, Sally Hemings was pregnant at the time, and she didn't wish to return to Virginia when Jefferson and his daughters were returning. The other thing that Sally did while she was in Paris was that she learned to bargain. Naturally, she and especially her brother Jamie did not want to return to the enslaved condition again.
Jefferson convinced Sally's brother, James, to return to America by promising to give him his freedom if he would stay home long enough to teach a replacement what he had learned of French cooking. Sally finally agreed to go home to Monticello as well, but not before striking her own deal.
Thomas Jefferson made extraordinary promises to her, including the fact that her children would be freed at age 21. She took him at his word, and the number of people say to me, you know, why would she trust him? You know, and that's a very difficult question to answer, but evidently she did and believed that he would do what he said.
The account of Madison Hemings of Jefferson's pledges to Sally Hemings suggests that she had some measure of control over her own life, that there was some mutual trust between the two of them.
Sally and Jane sailed back to Virginia with Jefferson in 1789. Madison Hemings' memoirs state that soon after Sally returned to Monticello, she gave birth to a child of whom Thomas Jefferson was the father. He lived but a short time.
There's no record of this child in Jefferson's records, but he didn't have complete records of the slave population at this time. Was there a child? We don't know whether it was a boy or a girl, what the child's name was. None of that is really known.
Jefferson returned to a burgeoning political career. While he was in Europe, the United States Constitution had been written and adopted. He was called on by President George Washington to serve as the nation's first Secretary of State. Jefferson divided his time between the Capitol in New York and his beloved Virginia. On the mountaintop at Monticello, Sally Hemings' life had also changed drastically.
Sally Hemings had had all of these wonderful experiences while she was living as the free person in Paris. So when she gets back to Monticello, it's back to the drudgery of slavery. There's something about being a slave that had to have torn psyche down. That self-esteem that she built up, I just wonder how it had begun to collapse when she returned to Monticello.
Sally became pregnant again in 1795, during a period when Jefferson was at home in Virginia. She gave birth to a daughter in October of that year, but the girl died at the age of two. In 1796, Thomas Jefferson ran for president, but came in second to John Adams. In accordance with the Constitution at that time, Jefferson became vice president. The two men disagreed strongly about national policy, a situation that quickly stirred up intrigue and backstabbing. Sally Hemings might have thought that she was far removed from the political wrangling, but accounts of her relationship with Thomas Jefferson were about to become fodder for newspapers across the country. By 1797, Sally Hemings had been back from Paris for 8 years and had resumed her role as a slave at Monticello. Her master, Vice President Thomas Jefferson, was away much of the time, plotting against his arch rival and boss, President John Adams. Yet in April 1798, 25-year-old Sally gave birth to her first recorded son, Beverly.
A very striking pattern emerges from this comparison of this information, in that of the six children born to Sally Hemings that we know of from Jefferson's records, all were conceived when Jefferson was at Monticello, and several of them were conceived within 3 weeks of his return from an absence in Philadelphia or Washington.
Sally's duties at Monticello were comparatively light after her return from Paris. She took care of Jefferson's chamber and wardrobe, looked after the children, and did some housework and sewing.
When Sally realized what her fate in life was going to be, when she returned to Monticello as a slave, it seems that Sally pretty much lived for this promise that she was able to extract from Thomas Jefferson while she was in Paris, that her children would be freed at age 21.
Hemings lived in several locations near the hilltop at Monticello before she apparently settled into one of the servants' rooms under the south terrace. Jefferson's daughter Patsy, now 27, watched over the plantation while her father was away. 25-year-old Sally was obliged to follow Patsy's orders, regardless of her status as Jefferson's mistress and the unspoken reality that Sally was Patsy's aunt.
She lived in a house with her half-sister's child in charge, telling her what to do. So it must have been a very difficult role for her to be. She must have been a heck of a diplomat to be able to skate on this ice that was so thin.
If Sally ever decided that she made a mistake leaving France and not taking her freedom, what could she do about that? Nothing. She would be stuck with her decision. So it would also put her in a situation that she would have to find a way to live as best she could based on what was available to her.
While Sally Hemings tended to Jefferson's home and the children, the vice president spent most of his time in Philadelphia, embroiled in the struggles of the new American government.
The relationship between Jefferson and Hemings made sense for Jefferson. He was a man obsessed with control. It meant that he could devote the bulk of his other energies to his public career without the customary obligations of a husband.
He had an unexpected bonus. He had Martha's half-sister. Now, having someone who's beautiful, has a spirit and personality and essence of this woman that you loved, but also someone that you own, gives you a situation where you can have your cake and eat it too.
he didn't have to be faithful to her, and we have heard of no other woman during that tenure that occupied his interest, at least publicly. So we think that he was fascinated with her, and that was quite a trick. They were together longer than some marriages exist. Yes, I understand she was a slave, but I also know that slaves did fall in love at some time with their masters. To say that there could be no feeling is to say that someone that is enslaved is not lovable. To say that there could not have been feeling on the part of Sally also says that a slave could not love.
Whether it was love or just convenience, their relationship would not remain private for long. By 1799, a full-blown political war was raging in Philadelphia. Vice President Thomas Jefferson had secretly enlisted a journalist named James Callender to attack his political enemies, in particular, President John Adams. Criticism of government officials was illegal at the time under the Sedition Act, and Callender ended up in jail. His work didn't entirely tip the scales of victory in the next presidential election, but Jefferson did beat Adams, and Jefferson was sworn in as the third president of the United States in March 1801. Shortly afterwards, Callender was released from jail.
He served a year in this really miserable jail, and he suffered. So he said, okay, I'd like to be the postmaster in Fort Richmond. And please also pay my fine that I had to pay, and I can't afford the $200. And essentially, Jefferson said, you're too hot now. Goodbye and good luck.
Callender brooded for a year over this betrayal before he struck back in the way he knew best.
When Jefferson didn't give him an appointment as postmaster of Richmond, he turned against them, and he used whatever was at his disposal. Sally Hemings was just a tool.
Callender had picked up enough evidence of Jefferson's relationship with Hemings to write an article about it in the Richmond Recorder.
He broke the story in September of 1802 of the woman he called the Dusky Sally. Well, the story exploded after he found out that she appeared white. He stopped calling her that and referred to her as the African Venus.
A series of articles explained that Jefferson and Hemings had begun a relationship in Paris and that the pair had children. Callender wrote, "It is well known that the man whom it delighteth the people to honor keeps and for many years has kept as his concubine one of his slaves. Her name is Sally." Newspapers across the country picked up the story.
As Callender knew, the scandal in Virginia was not so much that the plantation owner was making use sexually of a slave, because that happened all the time. It was that he treated her with respect.
Jefferson himself never directly denied the allegation, but his supporters did. What they could not deny was that there was a slave at Jefferson's home in Virginia named Sally, and that her children bore an uncanny resemblance to the President of the United States. The public was titillated, but Jefferson played the scandal perfectly.
He did things according to the rules of that game. As long as he did take Sally down to the church if they were going to get married, things were fine.
The story had no long-lasting effect on Jefferson's presidency, and in 1804, he won re-election by a landslide. As for Sally Hemings, no one knows if she had any reaction to the scandals or even saw the articles about herself.
There's been questions as to whether or not Sally was literate or not, whether could she read and write. I question if she really did.
Even if Sally was literate, she left no documents behind. But almost 200 years later, DNA test would speak louder than any letter in her own hand ever could. The Jefferson-Hemings sex scandal was still circulating in the newspapers of 1805, but Sally Hemings' life at Monticello maintained its normal pace. The 35-year-old gave birth to a son, Madison, that year. 3 years later, another boy, Eston, was born. Sally's master, Thomas Jefferson, was now 65 and starting to slow down. His second term as president ended in 1809, and Jefferson returned to Monticello for good. His oldest daughter, Patsy, had moved in with her 11 children, and Jefferson loved his role as patriarch and doting grandfather. It was a part he never played with Hemings' children, something that bothered Sally's son, Madison, a great deal. In his memoirs, he recalled that Jefferson was not in the habit of showing partiality or fatherly affection to us children. We were the only children of his by a slave woman. He was affectionate toward his white grandchildren.
Jefferson never acknowledged his paternity of Sally's children. Jefferson recognized that if he were to admit that he was the father, this would have been politically disadvantageous, very harmful to him at that time. But even more important to Jefferson was his own survival in the memory of posterity.
While Jefferson wasn't affectionate to her children, Sally Hemings did achieve one important victory. Jefferson kept the promise he made to her in Paris 30 years earlier. In 1822, Sally's older children, Beverly and Harriet, turned 21 and were noted in Jefferson's farm book as runaways.
There were runaways periodically over the course of Jefferson's life as a slaveholder, and he usually made an attempt to recover his escaped slaves and would expend considerable money to bring them back to Monticello.
But not Sally's children. They were allowed to leave. Harriet was even given $50 and put on a stagecoach. Noting them as runaways was an unofficial method of freeing them. Both passed as white, later married, and lived in white society. Jefferson's actions may have given them their freedom, but it was their mother, Sally, who traded her freedom for theirs and prepared them for life after slavery.
Sally did give her children a head start in the world. She certainly raised them to be hardworking and skillful and literate. She taught them a way to get around in the world.
On July 4, 1826, 4 years after freeing Sally's children, and 50 years to the day after signing the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson died. In Jefferson's will, he freed only 5 of his 130 slaves. All were members of the Hemings clan. 3 were older men, well past their prime. The other 2 were 21-year-old Madison Hemings and 18-year-old Eston.
Not only did Thomas Jefferson free these 2 boys, he also made a petition to the legislature to allow them to stay in the state of Virginia. The rule at that time was that if you're a freed slave and you stay in the state of Virginia past a year, you automatically could become enslaved again.
Madison and Eston Hemings did stay in Virginia as free men. But Sally was not freed in Jefferson's will.
He actually told his daughter to free Sally after he had died. So she did what's called giving her her time, which was letting a slave go and not requiring that the slave be chased down and recaptured.
She could live away from Monticello, and she could live with her sons and live out her days as a person who had freedom, but not quite.
Hemings and her 2 sons moved to the town of Charlottesville near Monticello. She lived in a house on West Main Street until she died at the age of 62, 9 years after Jefferson. There is no record of where she was buried. Her sons moved to Ohio after her death. Even though they could have passed into white society like their siblings, they lived as black men. Later, Eston moved his family to Wisconsin and into white society. Before the DNA results, the idea of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings' relationship was widely discredited. slow accumulation of letters and documents over two centuries brought no definite answer, and oral histories were often ignored.
The simple answer to why no one has paid attention to the Hemings family history or any of the other slave histories up until now is racism. I think that historians presumed because it's not written down, and because it's oral history, and because the oral history began with slaves, that it can't be trusted.
Jefferson is so symbolic of the contradictions in American history and society, freedom and slavery, that Sally Hemings has been a symbol as well, often of the denial of African-American oral traditions, even of the African-American presence.
In 1998, science intervened. New advances in DNA testing allowed for a sort of historical paternity test. Researchers examined Y chromosomes, which are the same in all male members of any given family. Blood from Eston Hemings' great-great-grandson was tested against that of several Jefferson men to see if the Y chromosomes matched. The test was positive. They were all genetic Jeffersons.
Taken together with all of the extensive historical evidence, this piece of information tipped the balance. It seems most probable that Thomas Jefferson was the father.
Finally, after all these years have gone by, they're going to have to spend their time trying to disprove themselves rather than me. When we look at our family, the descendants of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson, we number probably anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people.
The relationship between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson might never be proven beyond the shadow of a doubt. And whether she loved Jefferson or simply accepted her fate, one thing is certain. Sally Hemings left a legacy to her children and the American people.
She was able to do in her lifetime what many other enslaved women wanted to do in theirs, which was to leave their children a legacy of freedom. It's not a bad thing to have a mixed heritage. It's a wonderful thing if America could just see that in their own families. But it's not about color, it's about family, and it's about loving and relating to people as people.
America herself was built on imperfect people trying to come together as one, and they made so many mistakes along the way. Why do we assume now that those same people were perfect? And we hope that we can give somebody a gift from our heritage to say it's okay to talk about it.
Well, you just had an opportunity to hear about the biography of Sally Hemings, a young lady who was born into slavery and continued to live as a slave until after Thomas Jefferson passed on. And she had a 6 or 7 children with him, 2 which had died. He did keep his promise to allow the sons to be freed at age 21. It's very interesting when you really take a look at what was going on at that time and how so many African children, so many African females were raped. And, you know, there are all kinds of stories about what happened to George Washington and why so many black people have the last name called Washington. But I had promised to you that I was going to pass on some other information to you about 2 other great women. And the first one we're going to talk about is Harriet Tubman, and the other one is Sojourner Truth. Let's give a listen.
Let me, father, let me be.
Harriet Tubman. They called her the Moses of her people. Because of that, because she led so many people out of slavery, like the Moses of old. She led them out on what they called the Underground Railroad. Of course, you understand, it wasn't a real railroad at all. It was a network of people who, like Harriet, believed that it was okay for slaves to escape from slavery. 900 miles of walking late at night through swamps, through woods, and chase the dogs sometimes. And don't you know, sometimes people would get scared and want to go back. But Harriet, she always kept a six-shooter strapped to her side underneath the skirt. And they got to get nervous and scared. She'd pull that six-shooter out and say, all right, you move on or you'll die. Everybody would move on. She brought over 300 people out of slavery like that on the Underground Railroad and never lost a passenger.
Harriet Tubman was born Harriet Ross around 1820. Her exact birthday isn't known because, like many slaves, her date of birth was never recorded. She lived with her parents and 10 brothers and sisters on a plantation on the eastern shore of Maryland. When Harriet was 5 years old, she was hired out as a domestic servant. She slept on the kitchen floor, poking her feet under the fireplace ashes when the nights grew cold. For meals, she shared table scraps with her master's dogs.
Actual slavery was economic, it was legal, it was personal. It was a situation in which the slave had no rights. A person who was a slave could not walk down the next block without having someone else who owned her or who owned him say explicitly, yes, you may do that. A slave was someone who could be forced to work from the age of 8, 6, 4 even, long hours at tasks that someone else decided.
Young Harriet repeatedly failed at domestic work, and by the time she was in her early teens, was known as a strong but surly laborer, unfit for indoor work, yet useful as a field hand. She could plow, chop wood, and drive a team of oxen more efficiently than most men.
She worked on the farm like the men, hoeing and planting and plowing and that kind of work. And her overseer would whip her every day. Every day she would get whipped.
She had to be more or less obedient to her master. They told her when to go to bed, when to get up, when to work and such. And she had a rebellious spirit, and she said that slavery was against the law of God.
In 1831, when Harriet was about 11, Nat Turner, a slave on a Virginia plantation, led an army of 60 rebel slaves against their white masters.
The slaves are known to have used protests virtually from their time of departure from the slave castles on the African west coast, primarily, in which they resisted the attempt to be enslaved, to become enslaved. They attempted to escape on ships by simply, if the opportunity offered itself, by leaping off and drowning or whatever. Once they were bound by the continental United States, the protests took the form more of insurrection, slaves fighting against the system, and they fought against the system whether they were in the North or the South.
I'm going across the rivers of the Jordan. I'm going across the rivers of the Jordan, some of these days. Hallelujah, I'm going across the rivers of Jordan. Thank God you treat me some of these days.
When Harriet was 15 years old, her compassionate nature proved to have disastrous results.
Because she had chosen to block the door when there was an attempt to capture a runaway slave, and she herself was placed in the way of a 2-pound weight which struck her head and which undoubtedly fractured her skull and left her with some sort of affliction.
Harriet fell into a coma and endured a long period of recovery.
As I lay so sick on my bed from Christmas to March, I was always praying for poor old Master. Oh, Lord, convert old Master. Change that man's heart and make him a Christian.
She suffered periodic sleeping fits for the rest of her life as a result of this injury. In 1844, Harriet married John Tubman, a free black man, but this did not change Harriet's status as a slave. Her husband, like her masters, wanted to control her, threatening that if she were to run away, he would betray her. In 1849, Tubman's worst fears came true. She heard that two of her sisters had been sold and were already in chains heading south.
Then I heard that as soon as I was able to move, I was to be sent with my brothers in a chain gang to the far south.
Harriet knew it was time to go, and she persuaded three of her brothers to go with her. Her father had shown her how to use the night sky as a compass. She assured her brothers that she could guide them. Harriet Tubman knew better than to ask her husband to come along, or even to let him know that she was going. She left at night with her brothers, but fearing the unknown, they insisted on turning back. Harriet turned back with them. Harriet learned through another slave that she was scheduled to be sold south the next day. This time she knew she would have to run away alone. She had learned an important lesson which she would never forget. Freedom is only for those bold enough to take it. Not able to trust her husband, Tubman wanted someone in her family to know she was leaving on her own, that she was not on her way south.
She walked by the big house where her sister was working and started singing, "Swing low, sweet heaven, I ain't got long to stay here." So Mary Ann took the, got the message, and she knew what the message was.
They would use coded messages to slave spirituals. So they said, walk together, children, don't become weary. We're going to make it to the promised land. I have shoes, you have shoes, all God's children have shoes. When you get to heaven, going to put on their shoes and walk all over God's heaven. Heaven was a code word for Canada.
When night fell, a stranger hid Tubman in the back of his farm wagon, covered her with vegetables, and drove her to the first stop on the Underground Railroad. She began to learn the route she was to use so often and so effectively in the future. The Underground Railroad was a loose network of people willing to hide runaway slaves in their homes and conduct them to the next station or safe house. Traveling by night, hiding in the daylight, Tubman trudged through 90 miles of swamp and woodland. At last, many days after she started, she found herself across the magic line on free soil.
I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person now that I was free. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came like gold through the trees and over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven.
Making her way to Philadelphia, Harriet was able to get a job in a hotel kitchen. The city had an active abolitionist community.
The Philadelphia Vigilance Committee was a very important group engaged in aiding fugitive slaves. It was a group that had operated from the late 1830s into the early 1840s, and it was comprised of fugitives as well as free blacks and white supporters. It was a group that aided the Underground Railroad, and their primary job was to aid fugitives with food and clothing and money and to direct them on to other places. When Harriet Tubman arrived in Philadelphia, she affiliated herself with this group, and this group supported her in her return to Maryland and the Eastern Shore to free other fugitives.
Usually when slaves arrive with Harriet Tubman, first in the Johnson house or any other house along the Freedom Trail, the first thing she would do, she would give a soft knock on the door, and usually there was an answer, "Who's there?" A friend with a friend. It was a coded words. Then the occupant would know that Harriet Tubman was there or another conducting underground with slaves. And the password was given, and the passwords were returned.
So Harriet Tubman is someone who, through her own devices, through her own exertion, overcame slavery, became free, and then even more so, went back and brought other people with her. So she has freedom, 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 freedom.
Harriet made many trips south, but by 1851, the Fugitive Slave Act made these trips all the more dangerous. Tubman heard ominous news of fugitive slaves arrested and returned to the South from previously safe cities in Massachusetts and New York.
I never closed my eyes that I did not imagine that I saw the horsemen coming and heard the screams of women and children as they were being dragged away.
Philadelphia was no longer a safe place for Harriet to work. She moved to St. Catharines, Canada, a small town near Niagara Falls, where many free blacks and former slaves had settled. Now, instead of 90 miles, she had to conduct her passengers on a grueling journey of almost 500 miles.
She stole away into the night and crept along the various slave quarters or cabins, oftentimes whispering or knocking on doors, more or less singing, "Oh, steal away, steal away, steal away to Jesus. I ain't got long to stay here," or the code of spiritual, informing the slaves to steal away.
She was a very courageous and brave woman as she, you know, in turn escaped from slavery and then went back to help others do the same. So she, even in the early stages, she was giving back to her, you could call her community. She was helping her brothers and sisters get to where she had already gotten.
By 1854, Harriet Tubman had become a legend among the slaves and a demon to the slaveholders. Posters announced a reward for Harriet Tubman, sometimes called Moses, worth $12,000 to any person who delivered her to the authorities. The countryside swarmed with bounty hunters. In 1857, Tubman settled down in Auburn, New York. The small town was to be Tubman's home for the rest of her life. Before emancipation, she would make 19 excursions into the South, delivering more than 300 slaves, including families, from the land that had tried and failed to keep her in bondage. It was on these pilgrimages that she met Frederick Douglass and John Brown, leaders in the abolitionist movement. John Brown recruited a small band of free blacks and fugitive slaves for an attack on the arsenal in Harper's Ferry. What he needed now was black leadership, charismatic figures who could inspire and lead these volunteers. He believed there were two such leaders in the United States, Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman. During the winter of 1858 and 59, Tubman met with John Brown and others in Boston to confer about the plans at Harper's Ferry.
Harriet Tubman would have been with John Brown at Harper's Ferry had she not become ill at the time. And so, therefore, I think that the course of history was changed, perhaps, by her illness.
Brown's efforts failed. He was captured, tried, and executed.
After the Harper's Ferry raid was a failure,
Harriet Tubman, like many other African-American abolitionists, had to distance herself from Brown and from the raid because her name, like that of Douglas and many others, was bantered around as one of those who was supported and involved in the raid indirectly.
As the North-South split widened, the South called for strict enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act and an end to the Underground Railroad.
There were many people who didn't like the idea that the Underground Railroad was existing at all. Black people and white people, there were black spies and white spies who would sell their soul for $5, for a bottle of liquor, whatever, to reveal the hiding places of these fugitive slaves.
The issue of slavery continued to divide the Union. 7 states in the South withdrew from the Union to form the Confederate States of America. The Civil War had begun.
We mourn not that the man should toil. 'Tis nature's need, 'tis God's decree. But let the hand that tills the soil be like the wind that fans it free.
As Union troops advanced through Maryland in the spring and summer of 1861, large numbers of slaves left their plantations to join the Northern soldiers. These contrabands, many of them illiterate, malnourished, and ill, flooded the Union Army camps. Overwhelmed, Union Army commanders sent out a call for teachers and nurses. Hundreds of Northerners responded, among them Harriet Tubman. Aware of her work on the Underground Railroad, Union officers sometimes used her to lead spy missions.
She was called to lead a group of soldiers because she knew the elements, you know, the forests, the swamps, and so forth. So she led them into a small skirmish, and she was able to retrieve valuable information during that period for the Union Army.
Later that year, Tubman accepted an assignment to lead a force of 150 black soldiers and 3 steam-powered gunboats up the Combahee River. They destroyed Confederate munitions and supplies, and in the process freed 800 slaves. To Tubman's credit, no one was killed or even hurt. She would continue to perform this important work until the war ended, almost 2 years later.
She was not formally employed. She was informally employed, but that was not unusual at that time. Many others were also. So she was neither paid during the war, and after the war, she did not receive it. The government turned her down. And it meant then that for many years, and particularly as she got older, that she became poverty-stricken. And had it not been for the National Association of Colored Women, who, when finding out about her condition, had a national campaign to raise monies to aid her, and indeed they did until her death. This is one of the tragedies of American history, that it refused to recognize the singular services of an American patriot like Harriet Tubman.
When Tubman returned to her home in Auburn, she was about 45 years old, penniless and responsible for 2 aged parents. She planted apple trees and broke ground for a large vegetable garden to feed her family and anyone who came to her door.
After the Civil War, Harriet Tubman settled in Auburn, New York, where she became very active in aiding other African Americans. In many of the communities of the North, like Auburn, you had a number of blacks who were very poor. Many of them worked as laborers. Some of them could not get work. But there was a real problem in that period because institutions for the aged, institutions for delinquents, orphans, and others
were not readily available to African Americans. She determined that she would set up a home for the aged there in her own home, and indeed she did.
Appearing at her door in 1869 was another visitor, a tall, handsome man named Nelson Davis. Tubman had met him at a South Carolina Army base. The former soldier asked the former spy to marry him. Despite their age difference of 24 years, she accepted. At about this time, Sarah Bradford began writing Harriet's biography. It was first printed in 1869 under the title Scenes in the Life of Harriet Tubman. Bradford published the book, then turned its proceeds, some $1,200, over to Tubman.
Harriet Tubman was able to escape from slavery herself, returned to slave territory numerous times, helped hundreds of other slaves to escape, and has been called the Moses of her people in the terms of leading the slaves out of slavery into freedom. And she lived a very long and fruitful life, and I think is a shining example of the kinds of things that women were able to achieve under very difficult circumstances.
On March 10, 1913, Harriet Tubman died of pneumonia at the age of 93.
I came back to Auburn on this beautiful green evergreen tree that shades her grave in a silent cemetery, and I broke down. My emotional armor broke down, and I cried. And I said to myself, how did this woman do it? How did she lead 300 passengers to freedom and never lost one on the Underground Railroad?
I have wrought in the day, you in the night. I have had the applause of the crowd and the satisfaction that comes from being approved by the multitude, while the most that you have done has been witnessed by a few trembling guards and footsore bondmen and women, whom you have led out of the house of bondage, and whose heartfelt God bless you has been your only reward.
Coming for to carry me home.
Heard it about Harriet Tubman, a movie about her was done not so long ago, and you found out a lot of things about what she actually went through. On one hand, we heard about the life and times of Sally Hemings, who lived in slavery and did not and had an opportunity to stay in Paris, France, and not be a slave, but went on back home to Virginia with the person she evidently had some strong affection for. Here we hear about Harriet Tubman, who loved freedom and did as much as she could to help others live through that process to get to freedom. That she carried a gun on the side of a hip. Yeah, because people can be discouraged and scared. It's almost like you being out in the middle of an ocean and not knowing where you're going. She did. She knew. She followed the North Star. But we're going to go on now. We talked about Harriet Tubman. Let's see what we can find about this other great person who lived around this time. Let's listen.
She escaped from slavery, Sojourner Truth chose her own free name and became a great abolitionist leader. As she traveled the country speaking the truth about slavery, she discovered that there was another form of oppression. Like slaves, white women couldn't own property, couldn't vote, couldn't speak in public. She saw these people as allies in the struggle for freedom. At a convention where women's rights were being debated, she heard preachers and scholars make the argument that women were too weak to have equal rights. They needed to be helped out of carriages, helped over mud puddles, and given the best place everywhere. But she rose to speak and tried to stop Sojourner from coming to the podium, but she said, "Nobody ever helped me out of carriages or helped me across puddles or give me the best place anywhere. Ain't I a woman?" She pulled up the sleeve of her shirt and showed a strong black arm and said, "I have worked the fields and loaded the barns, and no man has bested me. And ain't I a woman? I have birthed many children, and when I see them sold off into slavery, none but Jesus heard my cry. And ain't I a woman?" The convention was riveted by her speech. And when she sat down, she had made the cry, sounded the call for all women to take up the struggle against oppression.
Sojourner Truth was born into slavery under the name Isabella in New York State in 1797. By the time she was born, slaves had been bought and sold in the New York area for over 150 years.
Sojourner Truth was a slave in New York State, and we don't usually connect New York State or indeed New Jersey or Pennsylvania with slavery, but they were all slave states. She was emancipated in 1827 by state law, which meant that she grew up as a slave. Now, for Sojourner Truth, this meant that she only knew her parents for a short time and that she was separated from her parents very early. This was the case with slaves very often throughout the country. Slaves were subject to sale, but even if they weren't sold away from their children or their parents, people lived on different plantations and different farms, so families were not together.
Slavery is a system in the United States, as it were, where individuals were owned as property by other individuals. It was a system of chattel slavery, which the individual had no rights.
A slave was someone who could be forced to work from the age of 8, 6, 4 even, long hours at tasks that someone else decided. A slave was a person who had no right to a vacation. A slave was a person who had no rights to wages.
And it is a system which existed here for several hundred years and which continues to permeate, I think, present-day society in terms of how we react to certain racial relationships in this country.
Isabella's family was owned by a man named Hardenberg, who was of Dutch descent. She heard only Dutch as she grew up, so this was her first language. When she was about 11 years old, her master died, and his heirs auctioned off his horses, his cattle, and his slaves. Isabella was sold to a man named John Neely, who owned a store and dock in nearby Kingston, New York. One Sunday morning, her master took her to the barn where he beat her with red-hot iron rods without reason. Although Isabella pleaded with him to stop and called out to God for help, the beating continued until her back was covered with blood.
A slave was someone who could be beaten, and masters and overseers routinely used force or the threat of force in order to coerce workers to do what they wanted. So slave children were not likely to stay with their parents as they grew up, and they were very likely to have been beaten, what we'd consider child abuse.
Isabella's father learned about the brutal punishment that his daughter had received, and he was able to persuade a local fisherman named Martin Shriver to buy her from the Neelys. Isabella was sold once again in 1810. Her new owner was patient and relatively kind, but his wife was mean-spirited and took an instant dislike to her quiet-spoken new slave. Isabella was often badly treated by her mistress and co-workers in the Dumont household. But she had been taught to repay evil with good, and she had developed a deep spiritual belief that her hard work would eventually be rewarded. She agreed to accept, as her husband, one of Dumont's older slaves.
Frequently, slaves did not have a choice in terms of whom they married. Masters, quite frequently, did not favor their slaves marrying persons on other plantations because they would not be able to exert full control over their lives. So Jenna Truth then contracted a marriage with an older man. It does not appear that this marriage was contracted because they were greatly in love. It was more a marriage of convenience. However, she did bear him several children.
Year after year, Isabella planted corn, chopped wood, and hauled buckets of water to the Dumonts. In 1824, good news finally reached her. Pressured by abolitionist groups, the New York State Legislature passed an emancipation law requiring that all slaves born before July 4, 1799, be freed on July 4th, 1827. Although no one knew for sure where Isabella had been born, the Dumonts agreed that she was eligible to be freed in 1827.
The slaveholders are terrible for promising to give you this or that, or such and such a privilege. If you will do thus and so, and when the time of fulfillment comes, and one claims the promise, they forsooth recollect nothing of the kind, and you are like as not, taunted with being a liar, or at best a slave is accused of not having performed his part or condition of the contract.
And she was not set free, but she was determined that she would be free, so she left. But she left her children in slavery because they had been assigned term slavery as such, and their freedom would come much later. As it happened, her child, Peter, was sold to another owner in New York and then sold to Alabama. Sojourner Truth checked the law and found out that it was illegal to sell a New York slave out of the state.
Sojourner Truth, or Isabella, went to court to get her son back. Her son had been illegally sold into perpetual slavery in Alabama. out of New York State. That she took this step showed that even as a slave, she was an extraordinarily strong person with a sense of autonomy, of personal autonomy, and of what her rights were, even though as a slave she had no legal rights. So she was an unusual person at that time, and she felt very strongly about her children.
A family by the name of Van Wagner offered to hide Isabella, but Dumont found her first. Wishing to help Isabella, the Van Wagners offered to buy her and her baby for a small sum. Dumont agreed, and Isabella was free. Isabella worked as a maid for the Van Wagners for 2 years, but like many former slaves, she thought of leaving the area in search of job opportunities in port cities along the East Coast. By this time, her husband, Thomas, had been emancipated. Isabella rarely saw him. They had agreed to go their separate ways. In the summer of 1828, Isabella and her son Peter headed down the Hudson River to New York City. With the help of a friend, Isabella soon found work as a domestic servant. She began to look for a church that she could join. She refused to sit in a church with segregated prayer rooms, so she decided to join a black congregation known as the Zion African Church.
And then when she was about 30 years old, she became a Methodist. She discovered Jesus, which changed her life tremendously. And this faith allowed her to transcend much of the tragedy of her youth and helped her become the person whom we know with this tremendous presence.
She devoted her free time to homeless young women at the Magdalen Asylum. The director was Elijah Pearson, a self-proclaimed minister. Pearson believed himself to be a man of great spiritual powers whom God had chosen to relieve the wretchedness of the poor in New York City. Isabella also believed that she could communicate directly with God, and in August 1831, she moved into Pearson's meeting house, becoming his full-time servant and a devout member of his religious sect. Pearson subsequently founded a religious community with Robert Matthews, who called himself Matthias.
Human truth belonged to a commune. We would call it a commune. They called it a kingdom, a religious commune, between 1832 and 1835. And it was at Zion Hill, Westchester County, New York, just outside of New York City. This commune was headed by a man named Matthias, who had been born Robert Matthews in upstate New York. And Matthias said he was a prophet. And he convinced several other Americans in New York that he was a prophet, and one of them was Isabella, Sojourner Truth. Now, Sojourner Truth, Isabella, was one of many Americans at the time who believed in what we think of now as rather unconventional religion. It was a fascinating brand of religion, and there seemed to have been cells of this kind of religion all over the antebellum North.
Isabella went to live at Zion Hill with Matthias, Pearson, and the Folgers, who owned the farm. However, she returned to New York City in 1834 after becoming disillusioned with their approach to religion. Not long after, a scandal erupted at Zion Hill. Pearson died, and his relatives accused Matthias of poisoning his fellow prophet and stealing his money. A New York newspaper printed a sensationalized account of life at Zion Hill. The story accused Isabella of being an evil witch who had single-handedly destroyed the peace and harmony that had once existed there. Offended by the accusations, Isabella filed a lawsuit against both Folger and the newspaper. She again won her case and received $125 in damages from the defendants. While continuing to work as a servant, Isabella realized her experiences as a slave, mother, and devout Christian had given her a perspective on human rights and spiritual well-being that she wanted to share with others. In her own mind, she heard powerful voices telling her that she had a mission to help the needy and the oppressed. Early in the summer of 1843, Isabella decided to act on God's command that she leave New York City and become a traveling preacher. But she wanted a new name, a free woman's name.
And the Lord gave me Sojourner, because I was to travel up and down the land, showing the people their sins and being a sign unto them. Afterwards, I told the Lord I wanted another name, because everybody else had two names, and the Lord gave me truth, because I was to declare the truth to the people.
Sojourner Truth became Sojourner Truth in 1843 when she was about 46, I think maybe close to 44 years old, but certainly she was a mature woman. And she felt that she should go out into the world, go to the East, which meant Brooklyn from New York City, and preach the gospel to convert souls.
From Brooklyn, Sojourner took a ship across Long Island Sound and proceeded northward, preaching in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Wherever she went, people flocked to listen to her.
She joined a commune called the Northampton Association in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is in western Massachusetts, which was an industrial commune. They made silk. And she stayed there for several years. And it was there that she became a supporter of women's rights and anti-slavery. She began to speak on the anti-slavery circuit in the late 1840s, and we first hear of her as a reformer in the very late 40s and the early 1850s.
While Truth was living at the association, she met many prominent public figures. Among the people were abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass. Although the importation of slaves into the United States was forbidden after 1808, slavery was still being practiced in most of the southern states. Led by Garrison and Douglass, the abolitionist movement sought to put an end to slavery. Olive Gilbert, an abolitionist friend of Truth's from Northampton, had been suggesting to Truth since 1847 that she share her story. Truth liked the idea, and in 1850, she and Gilbert published The Narrative of Sojourner Truth, which included an introduction by Garrison. Truth, who could not read the account of her own life, was able to support herself by selling copies of the book at abolitionist meetings.
Sojourner Truth, using her very strong religious beliefs, felt this need, this urge to travel the country, delivering her message of upliftment for black people. And ultimately did become someone who was involved in many other activities, including the abolitionist movement, including the women's movement.
During her stay at the Northampton Association, she heard lectures advocating that women be given the same political and legal rights enjoyed by men. Recognizing that she and the women's rights speakers were kindred spirits, Truth decided to join their ranks in yet another battle for freedom. Many women abolitionists compared the plight of the women in America to that of slaves in the South and declared that both women and slaves must be liberated.
She said, "I am against slavery because I know what it's like." And she was also a women's rights activist. And she said, I'm for women's rights because I know what it's like to be a woman who has no rights. That is the extreme of having no rights, of being enslaved."
At a women's rights convention in Akron, Ohio, Sojourner Truth made such a strong defense for the feminist cause that she aroused national attention.
Sojourner Truth today is best known by a tagline that is associated with a speech she gave in 1851. And that phrase is, it's a question, and aren't I a woman? And we understand that phrase to say, I am a woman too. Even though I am black, even though I am hardworking, I am a woman too. I deserve women's rights, and women deserve people's rights.
A well-known figure in the women's rights movement, Sojourner Truth also began speaking for the abolitionist cause. She became known for her simple but moving anti-slavery speeches and her witty, biting attacks on the hypocrisy of people who own slaves and yet profess to be Christians.
We know of Sojourner Truth as an anti-slavery women's rights supporter. She saw herself in the 19th century as a preacher who was bringing souls to Jesus.
Sojourner's preaching brought her to Rochester, New York, the the town where Frederick Douglass published his anti-slavery journal, The North Star. She gave many lectures during her extended stay in Rochester, whose residents were known for their strong abolitionist sympathies. During the rest of 1852 and 1853, Truth continued her lecture tour in Ohio and Michigan.
For women abolitionists, speaking in public was tremendously courageous. That the early 19th century was a time in which women did not generally speak in public. It was not considered the thing to do for respectable women.
In 1857, at the age of 60, Truth decided to move to Battle Creek, Michigan, a town with strong abolitionists. Truth was among the people who believed that slavery could still be ended peacefully. Years before, at an abolitionist meeting in Boston, Massachusetts, she and Frederick Douglass tangled over this very issue.
Frederick Douglass was despairing that slavery could be abolished peaceably, and he was calling on the slaves to rise up and seize their freedom through force of arms. Sojourner Truth was in the audience, and she stood up and she said, "Frederick, is God dead?" Meaning, "Frederick, have you lost your faith that God will bring our people through peaceably?"
In 1861, the Civil War broke out. Blacks and the anti-slavery societies hailed the war as a struggle to end slavery, but Americans viewed it chiefly as a battle to reunite the country. Sojourner Truth decided to make a tour of the Midwest and rouse support for the Union's war effort. Truth decided to visit President Lincoln in Washington, D.C. She met with Lincoln on the morning of October 29, 1864. She bluntly told him that she had never heard of him before he ran for president. Lincoln laughed, replying that he had heard of her for years and years. Truth thanked the president for all he had done for black Americans and asked him to sign her Book of Life, a collection of treasured autographs. In November, Lincoln was reelected by an overwhelming margin in the wake of several victories by the Union Army. Instead of returning to Battle Creek, Truth remained in Washington, D.C. She spoke at a local charity benefit to help raise money for black soldiers and joined a group of women who fed and nursed thousands of former slaves. Refugee camps were set up in Washington for slaves fleeing the South. Conditions at the camps were terrible, and the ex-slaves were constantly on guard against slave traders who kidnapped freed slaves and took them South. Most freedmen were afraid to speak out in protest. Truth, however, refused to be silenced. She marched through the freedmen's villages and told the slaves, "The law is for you. Take refuge in it." She worked for the National Freedmen's Relief Association, where she educated the freedmen about the need to find work and housing and other responsibilities that came with their newly won freedom.
I think Sojourner Truth was very bold in her day and age because she just went around telling people, you know, that she what she believed was wrong, that slavery was wrong. She had no money. She was poor. You know, she had no support. It was just herself. And I think that takes a lot of inner strength to pull that from within yourself to say, well, this is what I'm going to do. I strongly believe that this is wrong, and I'm going to speak out.
Truth was still in Washington the night President Lincoln was assassinated while watching a play at Ford's Theater. In the month following Lincoln's death, the last of the Confederate armies surrendered to Union forces. On December 12, 1865, Truth and millions of other Americans celebrated as Congress ratified the 13th Amendment, declaring that slavery was unlawful in the United States. Truth's prayers had been answered. She had lived to see the end of slavery. Staying in Washington, Truth prepared herself for a new mission, a campaign against racism. The slaves had been freed, but in the eyes of many whites throughout the country, blacks were not equal.
After the Civil War, Sojourner Truth became very active in reform primarily within the black community. She, like a number of other former abolitionists, like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper and many others, she lived in Washington, D.C. for a time prior to residing in Michigan. And while in Washington, She became involved in a variety of reform. She worked with freedmen. She worked with them there at the hospital. She worked with them locally in terms of addressing problems of discrimination in the city. And one particular area was in terms of public transportation. And she was a great organizer. She organized freedmen to protest for their rights.
In March of 1870, Congress ratified the 15th Amendment, guaranteeing the right to vote to all men, regardless of race, color, or previous condition of servitude.
Reconstruction was a moment in which black people, black men, were able to vote. So it meant access to political power. And political power in a democracy is fundamental.
Truth was still concerned about the impoverished freedmen who had flocked to Washington, D.C. She implored a white audience in Rochester, New York, to sign a petition to help former slaves resettle in the West.
Get these colored people out of Washington and off of the government, and get the old people out and build them homes in the West where they can feed themselves, and they would soon be able to be a people among you. That is my commission. Now agitate them, people, and put them there. Learn them to read one part of the time and learn them to work the other part of the time.
Her plan was never adopted. The tide of black progress continued to be blocked by conservative whites. Hayes became the 19th president of the United States in 1876. One of his first major acts as president was to withdraw the federal troops that were protecting the civil rights of Southern blacks. The action signaled the end of Reconstruction. Many gains that blacks had won after the Civil War would now be reversed. Truth did not have the strength to tour and protest. By the beginning of 1881, she had become gravely ill. She died early in the morning of November 26, 1883.
But she found it within herself to tell people what she believed was wrong and to tell people how she felt. And she stood up for what she believed in. And I believe that's very important, to not compromise yourself. If you believe that is wrong, and you really believe that, to let someone know, to tell them, to stand up for what you believe in, become active in that, and, you know, to really let people know.
All we know about Sojourner Truth is from the reports of the period, others, and how they saw Sojourner Truth. It appears that she was a woman of great presence, a woman of great strength, a woman whose presence and strength and sheer utterance could calm an audience, could rev an audience up, could move an audience to action. She was a woman of great strength and presence.
You've had an opportunity to hear about three distinguishable, great black women. One goes all the way back to the President of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, third President of the United States. And the other two were later on, Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman. Both ladies fighting for freedom on different levels. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. Harriet Tubman not only fought for her freedom, but for all those people that she helped move from the South to various parts of the North and the West, 300 or more. Here she did, it didn't make any difference whether they were male or female. On the other hand, we have Sojourner Truth, who actually lived to see people receive their freedom. And so did Harriet Tubman. The difference here was Sojourner Truth not only fought for the freedom of women, I mean, but men, but she also was all a part of the women's rights movement. She was one of the founders of the women's convention that was held in New York to give women their rights. So we have three distinguishable women that really were the breaking groundwork of what most men at that time couldn't even do. And the Sally story is a weird kind of story, because she lived with that man and she must have had some kind of feeling for him, but at the same time did look out for her children. And when you think about it, like my son-in-law said, it makes a lot of sense that she stayed right there. Most people were really bent out of shape by it at that particular time. However, when you really think about it, she was able to live on a level that a lot of people who had been slaves could not live. Thomas Jefferson was a very wealthy man, and at the same time was a very intelligent man who was the author of the Bill of Rights, and a tremendous writer. And many of his things, and actually built Monticello, he drew up the plans for that. He was deeply involved with a lot of different things. Strong mathematician and a surveyor. Actually, the founder of the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. So here we have three people that I wanted to bring to your attention, and hopefully you've had an opportunity to learn something like I have. There are things that I've known, but there are other things that I've wanted to know that didn't know and was able to find out. Next week, we're going to be talking about Johnny Cochran, who would be a well-known lawyer. But we're going to be talking about him on an hour-long show, and we'll probably talk about The Heritage of Slavery by Fannie Lou Hamer. So for those of you who have been listening, you've been hopefully enjoyed what I have tried to present and provide you for you. You've been listening to Getting It Done. And your host, for the most, is Dr. Walter Dean, me, myself, and I. Have a good week, and look forward to hearing and seeing you. If you're interested in being on the show, contact me at drdean1212@gmail.com. Have a good day, people.